You know, this democracy does not date back to 1776. It dates back to 1964 at best. And so we all need to be learning how to not just exercise democracy, but defend it.
Uno, dos, tres.
From Futuro Media and PRX, this is In the Thick, a podcast about politics, race, and culture. I'm Maria Hinojosa.
And I'm Julio Ricardo Varela.
I'm so excited. 2023 is looking good. When we get these guests back on our show, we're like, yeah, we love them. They love us.
One of the OGs.
One of the serious OGs joining us from Los Angeles, California is Jameel Smith. He's an essayist for the Los Angeles Times. Jameel, it's good to have you back on the show.
It's wonderful to be back. Thank you.
Yes. And joining us from Washington, D.C. is Sabrina Rodriguez, national political reporter for a little newspaper known as The Washington Post. Welcome back, Sabrina.
Hi, Maria. Thanks, as always, for having me.
Yeah, it's good to have the both of you. Now, listen, I'm recording in our Punta Cana studio, so I did just have to kill, like, a lot of mosquitoes. They're biting up my legs. And if you hear birds, that could be also in the background. I don't know about what's happening where Sabrina and Jameel are, but we are still recording from our home studio. So
yeah,
you have been forewarned. All right. So the both of you know the drill. You know that one of the things that we love to do on In the Thick is actually have the journalists who join us talk about how they are feeling about things. And so we actually want to talk first about feelings because it is a new year. It's 2023. Shit's already happening. It's already like, oh my God.
It's like, we're not even up to January 15th.
Exactly. But before we get into that roller coaster, we just want to do an emotional temperature check. So Jameel, como tu ta? How do you feel? How's your emotional state?
Well, considering that I'm in transition here, moving to Los Angeles and all of that, I think that I would say it's a bit discombobulated at the moment, but I mean, also the fact that it's pouring rain in Los Angeles right now.
Yeah.
That to me, all throughout California, I think it's a sign that 2023 is definitely has a lot of unexpected things in store.
Yeah, so a little discombobulated. I feel that. Sabrina, como tú estás? How are you feeling? What's your temperature check?
Muy bien. You know, there's a lot of craziness happening in D.C., but I'm good. I'm feeling very grateful starting off the year. My abuela turns 93 this weekend.
Oh, wow.
Beautiful.
She's going to get her show.
Oh, she has to. She has to. But yeah.
Eventually, when she meets Maria Hinojosa, it's over. Like, it's a show. I mean, she's amazing.
No, I'm very good on that end. Very excited to see her and get to spend it with her.
Qué bueno.
All right. Well, that was a nice little start. A little bit uplifting because, wow.
Yeah.
This is one of those shows where we had a plan to talk about certain things and then all of a sudden Brazil happened. So on Sunday in Brazil, in the capital city of Brasilia, thousands of supporters of the far right former president Jair Bolsonaro stormed the country's Congress, Supreme Court, and the presidential palace.
Mm-hmm.
So these scenes, I'm sure you've all seen them, these scenes of protesters mm-hmm. breaking through police lines and engaging in mob violence and vandalism kind of struck home, mm-hmm. at least because it looked very familiar to what happened in the United States just 2 years ago during the January 6th attempted coup in the U.S. Capitol. Both the attack in Brazil over the weekend and the one in Washington, D.C. 2 years ago were fueled by lies about election fraud. As of Monday morning, hundreds of protesters have been arrested, and the current president of Brazil, Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, love saying that name, who defeated Bolsonaro last year, has promised to bring the rioters to justice. I think the words terrorists have been used a lot in Portuguese in the last couple of days.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, Bolsonaro, who faces various investigations from his time in office, he's been in Florida
mm-hmm.
in the last month.
Lose an election, get the heck out of Dodge as possible.
Oh, why am I in Florida? Well, but anyway, there are calls for President Biden to extradite Bolsonaro back to Brazil. So before we dive in, we want to share a clip from two friends of the show, Mehdi Hassan and Ayman Mohyeldin, who talked about what happened last night on MSNBC's Mehdi Hassan show. So let's take a listen.
And I feel like it's doubly embarrassing for us in the United States because, number one, as Joe Walsh pointed out on the show at the start, everyone looks to America and they saw what happened on January the 6th. And the images out of Brazil are very much January the 6th like. And number two, the Brazilians actually have arrested, I believe, more than 400 people today which is not what we did on January the 6th. We allowed the insurrectionists to just go home. So I feel like it's doubly embarrassing watching these scenes, chaotic scenes out of Brazil today.
And not only that, look, I think you can look at what is happening in Brazil and see firsthand the motivation, the inspiration from what played out here on January the 6th and how it has played out and spread to countries like Brazil. Yep. But you know what's more troubling, Mehdi, is the reaction that we've seen from our own politicians to what is happening in Brazil. This is a major international crisis. The White House has come out condemn this violence. The president, the secretary of state, the national security advisor, Democratic officials have all said they are watching the situation closely, condemn it, and look forward to working with the duly elected president of Brazil, Lula. You know who we haven't heard from? It's not a surprise. A lot of the Republicans, many of whom tacitly supported and explicitly supported our own insurrection that happened in this country. So I think it's duly shameful what you outlined, but also what our own Republican officials here in this country are doing this evening as we watch this democracy, the largest democracy in South America, go through this turmoil.
You know, Julio, it feels very topsy-turvy.
Yeah.
Because the United States orchestrated coup d'etats in Latin America, Brazil, now watching the United States, inspired by the United States.
Yeah.
And so it is this topsy-turvy. I did not see this one in particular coming in this direct way, but my God, it looks exactly like January 6th.
It's very complicated. Like, Trump has learned from Bolsonaro and Bolsonaro has learned from Trump.
That's what I'm trying. It's a topsy-turvy, vicious circle.
Yeah. So, Sabrina, how do we think about the threat to democracy, not only in Brazil, but on a global level?
I mean, I think the number one thing on my mind is, you know, there's no question about the rise of these far-right movements, and we've seen, you know, them empowered. We've seen, for example, in Israel that they now have a far-right government as well, and we saw Bolsonaro's term and all the things he did during that time. I think for me, the question is seeing what happens now with Lula and him making sure that democracy stays in place. You know, I think for me, it's always the what happens after. You know, we saw after January 6th, like, democracy is alive. You know, there's been many questions around its survival and and looking at the 2022 election and stuff, there was obviously the concern about all the election deniers running for office and what would happen there. And I think for Brazil, it's that question as well. You know, I think we're seeing the right signals of Lula moving very quickly to arrest protesters, to reinforce that, you know, this is a democratic government and that they're going to fight to, you know, preserve rule of law and democracy. I think it's the right thing to be seeing, you know, members of Congress here in the U.S., particularly Democrats in this case, coming out and saying, you know, that Lula was a democratically elected president and kind of reinforcing that. So I think it's, for me, it's looking at us keeping democracy in place in the face of these movements that are just no question happening.
Right. Not a lot of Republicans have spoken out. Sabrina mentions the Democrats that have been speaking out. But Jamil, your thoughts on all this in the context of, you know, global ultra-right movements happening all over the world?
Well, I mean, first things first, I imagine Republicans wouldn't speak out about this because they supported a person who prompted one of these sieges right here in the United States. Mm-hmm. So having stood behind him, whether it's, you know, personally, ideologically, or both, I imagine that there's nothing much for them to say. Even if they did condemn it, those would be empty condemnations from a lot of them. But I think one of the most important things here that's noted is not simply what you and Mehdi drew attention to, which is the fact that people were arrested right after they committed the violence. One of the most important things here is that the violence happened after Lula had been inaugurated.
Yes.
And Applebaum pointed out in The Atlantic, he's not blocked from exercising his power.
Where Biden was a president-elect, you're saying.
Exactly.
Biden was not in power, but Lula was, so he can call the military. And
exactly. But also, the fact is that why then do it? You know, if you know that this probably is not going to reinstate Bolsonaro to power, why then do it? If the only reason may be to simply say, hey, we see what happened on January 6, 2021 in the United States, and we want to basically mimic that.
Yeah, we want to be you.
Exactly.
We see you, we meet you, we raise you. We want to be you.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost like a 2-year anniversary that they were celebrating and they just happened to celebrate it in Brasilia.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
So that to me, I think it has its own danger. And secondly, I think vocabulary is a weapon in this instance. And I saw a clip from a video that was published by the New York Times in which one of the detained Brazilian insurrectionists claimed that they were just protesters and that they were only trying to save their country. And it, you know, obviously that has echoes of what we hear from Trumpers here in the United States. But it's also inherent to totalitarian regimes that only one group can lay claim to a country.
Yeah.
That citizenship is a provenance that is only afforded to certain people. And if we don't understand that the danger is bigger than whether or not Bolsonaro mimics Trump or Trump mimics Bolsonaro, we need to understand that, you know, just like Brazil, we too are a young democracy.
Exactly.
And, you know, this democracy does not date back to 1776. It dates back to 1964 at best.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
And so we all need to be learning how to not just exercise democracy, but defend it.
This context from Jamil, like two brilliant guests as usual.
Right. And also, that's actually a very important time in Brazil's history, right?
Right.
It was the beginning of a dictatorship in the 1960s. And so it is this geopolitical reality that obviously leads us to our next point of discussion, right? You have to recognize that this is a North-South issue of the Americas. And so when we talk about immigration, our next issue, it is a North-South issue in the Americas, and that we have to find a way to do better. All right, so before he headed off to Mexico, President Joe Biden briefly visited the southern border in El Paso, Texas on Sunday. This is the first time that he's been there, been to the border since he took office. He was there to, quote unquote, assess border enforcement operations. Again, I think it would have been an incredible opportunity for him to just change the discourse and go hug some kids who are seeking refuge and asylum. But okay. In fact, the trip came just days after Biden announced an expansion of Title 42, restricting more migrants and more asylum seekers from Cuba, Nicaragua, and Haiti from crossing the border into the United States. Now, the fate of Title 42 has been up in the air since the Supreme Court blocked the Biden administration from ending the policy, right?
Yeah.
It's just very confusing for people. They're like, well, does it exist? Does it? Who created it? Whatever. The point is that it is a disaster. It is a level of inhumanity, which I hope we all remember and that we make better from now on. But, you know, for now, we've seen how Republican governors are actually trafficking people, busing migrants and refugees to so-called sanctuary cities, putting them in precarious situations because of the weather that they've been putting people in.
Yeah.
You know, super cold north when you're coming from places like Honduras, for example, or Nicaragua. So Republicans have been criticizing Biden for not being tougher on immigration, but this latest policy announcement is actually in line with what they've been calling for. And some Democrats are increasingly getting frustrated with Joe Biden, too, and are speaking up because it's like, enough already. You are not offering anything new. So this is what Texas Governor Greg Abbott, who has made border security a top priority, he says. I think it's very performative. This is what Greg Abbott told reporters on Sunday while meeting Biden at the airport. Let's go to the tape.
Okay.
But the president who caused the chaos of the border needed to be here. It just so happens he's 2 years and about $20 billion too late. He needs to step up and take swift action, including reimbursing the state of Texas for the money that we spent, but providing more resources for the federal government to do its job. Also, this is nothing but for show unless it begins to enforce the immigration laws already that exist in the United States of America that are contained in the letter that are provided to the president today.
Now, I hear you laughing, Jamil, because it's like, I hear this is all for show. And it's like, you're the one who is a performance artist at this point. I mean, the fact that Governor Abbott would even begin to say something about taking the conversation there, Joe Biden, in my view, is he's being dragged down into that rabbit hole because he is not changing up the narrative. And so everybody is coming at him and he's not, as I said, not offering anything new. And I didn't think, Sabrina, that I would end up in my career taking on Mexico and the United States, but on the issue of immigration, you know, that's what I do these days. So tell me, what are you making of Joe Biden's visit to Mexico and to this visit to the border?
Ay, Maria.
Yeah, right, I know.
But sit back. Ay, Maria.
Por favor.
This is going to be the context. Ay, Maria.
There's no other way than like deep sigh to start the... But
exacto.
I mean, look, the reality is that Joe Biden has now been president for 2 full years. This is the first trip that he's done to the southern border. And I think there's a very real question that Democrats that are focused on immigration and are focused on immigration reform and wanting to make changes, I think there's a real question to them if Biden has just ceded the ground for too long.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The reality is that over the past 2 years, Biden for a long time was reinforcing Title 42 and was, you know, using the argument that it was in the name of public health and that, oh, because of the pandemic, when obviously public health experts for months and months and years at this point were saying that this had nothing to do with the pandemic and that it was being used to control migration. I think it's no coincidence that he took this trip to El Paso, you know, just days after he announced a big immigration policy change. Mm-hmm. It just reinforces everything. You know, he wasn't going to make this trip to the southern border without announcing some type of hardline policy, which is counter to what he talked about on the campaign trail. I think, you know, he talked when he was campaigning about creating this humane, you know, immigration system and promoting all these reforms and basically being the opposite of who Trump was. And then here we are seeing him announce that he's going to be immediately turning away Cubans and Haitians and Nicaraguans crossing the border and just expanding around what he already did with Venezuela recently. Unfortunately, I will say, I don't think it's particularly surprising. I don't think it's particularly surprising to any of us that Congress over the past 2 years also has not, you know, achieved any kind of immigration reform. So it is kind of seeing more of the same. But for a president that talked so much about how he was going to be different than Trump.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. That's the bing, 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 bing. There you go. If you hadn't talked about how you were going to change things, this would be easier. But you made all of those promises. And yet again, mm-hmm. immigrants, refugees thrown under the bus. Jamil, your take on President Biden, the border going south, his relationship with Mexico, the visit.
Here's one thing. I mean, I happened to, on my road trip here to Los Angeles, I happened to stop through El Paso on New Year's Eve. And that's where I actually brought in the new year. I never thought that I would be there before President Biden was. And and let's just say this.
Shade.
I mean, listen, my biggest problem with the Title 42 expansion is that he is lending validity to Trump's excuse to discriminate against undocumented migrants.
Exacto.
Granted, you know, yes, there is still a pandemic going on. Let's not pretend that it isn't. I mean, people are still getting sick and we need to still be taking it seriously. But unfortunately, I don't think the administration, for one, is taking it as seriously as it needs to be. So you can't use public health as an excuse now to then bar even more migrants from the promise that we as Americans make to people not from this country, that you can be granted asylum if you require it. And so I have a lot of problems with that. Biden needs to sufficiently answer for why he is both leaving Title 42 in place and why he is expanding.
Yeah.
He has not done that yet.
Mm-hmm.
And I need to hear why, if you are expanding this as a matter of public health, why then are you not expanding other public health measures with regards to the pandemic?
Mm-hmm.
No, it's...
Well, it's hypocrisy, and it is, again, throwing immigrants and refugees literally under the bus again and again and again and again and again.
But there's no outrage, right? Even with the Title 42 announcement, the White House has taken the clear position that it's like, okay, we'll wait for the Supreme Court.
And our colleagues fall into that narrative, Jamil, again. You're just like, if you're not changing
and there's
it...
And now there's an app for that. You guys see the app comment? You know, like... All of a sudden, they use this program for Venezuela.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, oh, yeah, no, it's okay. It's still legal to claim asylum.
Just do it on an app. Get your iPhone.
Go get your phone and do it on an app from Honduras or Nicaragua or from Cuba.
Right. By the way, Haiti, Honduras, Nicaragua, some of the poorest countries in the Caribbean and Central America.
But Sabrina, you've covered this a lot. I haven't seen one Democrat, or at least prominent Democrat or migrant rights group that said, oh, yeah, Biden, this is a great idea. Like, he's been slammed. Have you seen anything to suggest otherwise?
Oh, no. I mean, there's none of the major groups are saying that this is a great idea, nor are Democrats that are deeply involved in these issues. Obviously, more moderate and then frontliner Democrats aren't going to say anything about this because people just don't want to talk about immigration. It's not even the giving a position or not. I mean, many Democrats just don't even want to touch the issue because Republicans have really taken ownership over it and really are the ones that are like driving the narrative around this. And seeing Biden do this just plays more into that hand.
Exactamente.
If I may add, the narrative is one of cruelty and dehumanization. It's not a policy argument.
Exactly.
And so, like, listen, I have my issues with Biden's expansion of Title 42 and his inaction with regards to immigration reform. But imagine the gall of a literal human trafficker like Governor Greg Abbott handing Biden a letter demanding better border security.
Exactly. Exactly.
I mean, this is a guy who sent more than 100 migrants to Vice President Harris's home on Christmas Eve during one of the coldest winters that Washington's had in decades, and did the same thing in September. And also, you know, his buddy Ron DeSantis in Florida spent taxpayer money to send folks up to Martha's Vineyard with no promise of shelter, purely in the matter of a deceptive effort, a deceptive stunt.
Yeah.
Simply to, it wasn't a matter of fixing anything.
If you want to talk about a stunt, and this is where I keep on saying, it would have been the perfect moment for Joe Biden to scold, in fact, Governor Abbott.
Yeah.
Scolding him and say, don't you ever traffic with human beings.
Yeah.
Again, it would have been a totally, it would have been like a watershed, whatever, you know that, but
all right,
instead, more of the same.
I would have refused to shake his hand.
Exactamente.
And you say, listen.
That's what, see, like, look, we're able to come up with performative politics for you here. Just like, take a cue.
Yeah. How on earth can you pretend that you're going to do business with somebody who is trafficking human beings for the sake of performative politics?
Yeah.
I mean, it takes a lot more than a condemning statement. You know, President Biden has to take a trip like this as an opportunity to say, this is where I stand on this issue as a human being, not simply as a politician.
From Futuro Media and PRX, Latino Rebels Radio is an award-winning OG Latino podcast covering stories of the Latino experience that matter in the United States, the Caribbean, Central America, South America, and even parts of the universe. Lo que sea. Created for, about, and by Latinos. Join us every Thursday by subscribing to Latino Rebels Radio, wherever you get your podcasts. Okay, so we want to talk about the latest in Congress. So early Saturday morning, in what was a post-midnight vote, Republican Kevin McCarthy finally flipped just enough votes to win the House Speaker role in the 15th round. It was like Rocky. That was round 15 against Apollo Creed. To win this, McCarthy had to offer many concessions to the extreme right wing of his party, including allowing any member to call for a motion to remove the speaker and making it harder for the House to raise spending, taxes, and the debt limit. Meanwhile, Democrats were totally united in support of their leader, Hakeem Jeffries, who is now in the minority party. That speech was, wow, okay.
Brooklyn in the House.
Like, it was an alphabet. I'm like, he did an alphabet.
House Democrats will always put American values over autocracy, benevolence over bigotry, the Constitution over the cult, democracy over demagogues, economic opportunity over extremism, freedom over fascism, governing over gaslighting. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Thursday, Ested Herndon, who's a national political reporter for the New York Times, also a friend of the show, was on another friend of the show, Brian Lehrer, on his show on WNYC, describing the impacts of all this. Let's take a listen.
We're talking about the difference of what policy means to this version of the Republican Party. Those rule changes are important because what Kevin McCarthy has had to agree to are investigations against the Biden family, are the kind of what many would consider a more conspiratorial wing of the Republican Party, really imprinting its agenda on the caucus at large. And so what they're looking for from McCarthy are commitments to be a thorn in the side of Biden, not only in policy or kind of making affirmative policy tackling issues coming from the House, but in an investigative fashion. They're looking to exact a score that they see being settled from the investigations into Donald Trump and how Congress was behaving, investigating his campaign during that administration. And so when we're talking about what are the policy extractions this group is looking for, we do have to broaden out how we see that, because it's not the typical legislative issue. What it is a tit-for-tat nature of, frankly, just politics.
Sabrina, I want to get past sort of the inside the beltway, you know, take on this. And you did cover Congress previously. But how do you begin to look at a divided Congress in the next couple of years, given what happened in the last week?
I mean, even before we saw what happened over the last week, just knowing that there is a divided Congress, knowing the Republicans have the House and Democrats have the Senate, you know, to not expect very much to come out of Congress over the next 2 years. Like, that is just the unfortunate reality of the world that we live in.
Yeah.
You know, that is the frustration of the American people. I mean, when people talk about being disillusioned with politics, being disillusioned with politicians, what we saw last week is the perfect example, the perfect embodiment of it, of these people arguing, they're not getting anything done. The longer they take to get a Speaker of the House, the longer it takes to get the members, you know, sworn in, and the longer it takes for them to start debating policy, which is what they're supposed to be doing. They're supposed to be there to make changes to policy to help the American people.
Right.
You know, I think it's clear that that was not the priority last week. And it is clear that with having a divided Congress where Republicans can't even get on the same page to vote for a Speaker of the House, you know, what can we expect them to actually get done in the next 2 years? It's such a long time in reality to think that for 2 years we're going to see all this back and forth fighting. Yeah. And just really envisioning any issue that they can all get on the same page on is really just hard to envision.
Mm-hmm. Probably everything but immigration. They'll probably all agree mm-hmm. on that. But mm-hmm. Jamil, I mean, talking about Republicans, what are your thoughts?
I mean, you know, this is, what more can we expect from the shit poster wing of the Republican Party?
Wow. Okay.
I mean, this is what these people are. I mean, listen, let's not make it any more than it is. These are people who have emulated the sort of conspiracy thinking of right-wing talk show hosts in Twitter aficionados who now have been elected to Congress, and not for their promise to actually write creative and forward-thinking legislation, but instead to simply echo the thoughts of people who want to vote for people who make them feel more comfortable with their opinions. It makes me actually think about what happened in Brazil a little bit, going back to the beginning of this conversation.
Yeah.
You saw all those people in soccer jerseys during the siege, right? Though that was rightfully condemned by the Brazilian Football Confederation, it kind of offered an insight into the politics that motivate this behavior. I mean, it's about being a fan, you know, being a fan of the team, you know, that lost and being upset that they lost. And being a fan generally, and I'd say this as a person who loves sports, is not necessarily about exercising critical thinking.
Hmm.
You know, your team wins, you're really happy, you're ecstatic. Your team loses, and you're sorrowful, resentful, potentially even hateful.
Yeah.
And you're encouraged, that behavior is encouraged.
Yeah.
And that's what these people do. The one good thing about it is I don't expect them to really pass any legislation, but of course, we need Congress to work, and certainly Democrats need Congress to work in order for people to think that the system can work for them. And you know, the only thing that Republicans are getting elected for, especially these folks who, you know, drove this revolt against McCarthy, the only thing that they're getting elected for is to simply represent the attitudes and opinions of their voters, not necessarily get anything done. It must be easy to maintain power when that's all you have to do.
Yeah. Thank you for that, Jamil. Also, on our little behind the scenes text, the lesson was, lesson number one, don't F with Jamil Smith, because we know what we'll have coming. So we got the message. And it's complicated, right? Julio, we love this piece that you recently wrote for MSNBC about how this new Congress is the most Latino and Latina Congress.
Yes.
47 members of the House of Representatives. And within that number, of course, there is a spectrum of political beliefs with far-right MAGA Republicans, but also a wave of new progressive candidates. Everybody, I'm sure you're following, Afro-Cuban, Maxwell Alejandro Frost, the first Gen Z member of Congress.
Yeah.
Of course, there's also Robert Garcia, the first LGBTQ immigrant and first Peruvian American to serve in Congress. And, you know, there is a lot of talk about the progressive wins from the last midterms, which kind of saved democracy, but also very specifically with progressive agendas. In fact, on MSNBC, Eugene Daniels was kind of like talking about the center on the issue of immigration. I was like, forget about the center. Like, let's get progressive. Let's talk about progressive politics, changing the narrative. Sabrina, are you looking at any of this and getting excited, or am I just getting excited? And shouldn't be.
I do not think that it is just you. I mean, if we look at, you know, like you mentioned, Frost and just so many of the members, and particularly the Latino members that we saw elected, you know, we all followed very much so in 2022 and after the 2020 elections, the whole narrative around, you know, Latino Republicans and our Republicans making all these inroads with Latinos. And I think when you look at the profiles of the people that ended up getting elected to Congress, it shows a much more mixed picture And it shows one of more progressive Latinos, you know, in politics, which I think, you know, is promising for us just adding more nuance to the discussion. Because even when we talk about Latinos as Democrats, not even take away the Republicans, Latinos piece of this, even when we talk about Latino Democrats, it's often been talked in the place of like Latinos are really moderate Democrats and they're much more centrist Democrats. So I think to see that diversity when we're talking about Latinos specifically is huge. But I think when we're talking more broadly about Congress's legislative priorities and such, I mean, to see more progressives in power, to see more progressives have a platform speaking up, like Frost, for example, that is just getting so much attention and being able to bring light, not just to policy issues, but to be able to bring light to him moving to Washington, D.C., and like, how is he supposed to get an apartment if he's getting rejected for having bad credit? I mean, those are conversations that I am really happy to see happening, because oftentimes when we're talking about politics, it's not just about the policy that's happening. It's not just about culture war issues or the infighting and stuff, but it's like, who are the people that are in power? And if someone can't get an apartment, I mean, that should be part of the conversation that we're happening, because it's reflective of this country and of Americans.
Jamil, Esperanza, is there hope there?
I mean, to some degree, I think if we just have to think about politics in a different way. I mean, I was talking with somebody last night about the lack of fluency, cultural fluency that people have in this country, particularly white people, concerning blackness, concerning, you know, the experience of Latinos and Latinas, basically the experience of anyone who isn't white. Mm-hmm. They don't have to become fluent in our experiences, you know, whereas we, from a very young age, have to learn how to navigate whiteness very, very carefully. And so my thing with regards to hopefulness is that, you know, I love in Julio's column that, you know, he asked, you know, say, if you're surprised that a Mexican-American representative belongs to the MAGA camp, you shouldn't be. And that's that to me is a sign that, like, I too, you know, I'm here in L.A. and I'm trying to bone up on my Spanish, but I can't just bone up on the language. I need to become fluent in the experiences of these people that live here if I'm going to be able to write about them effectively. So, and I think that, you know, the same needs to be true of politicians. And frankly, of citizens, if we're supposed to be responsible, and you know, with regards to the duties that we hold as voters, we need to become fluent in everyone's experiences to the point that to the best point that we can, so we can understand exactly what the hell is going on in America.
And that gives me hope, Maria.
He's going to start translating the West Coast for us. You're going to help me understand.
Yeah, no,
that
the cultural fluency, the way you framed it, that to me is the future of American politics if we want to move forward as a country.
Yeah.
The fact that we have to talk about these complexities that, you know, Maria has been covering, Sabrina, myself, in our communities. And the way you said that, we have to begin to understand it. I just wanted to quote one of Sabrina's colleagues in the Washington Post, Sylvia Foster Frau, talking about Robert Garcia, a Democrat. When he arrived in D.C. for orientation, cooks and janitors of Peruvian descent came to shake his hand.
Oh.
That's the stuff that gives me hope, is when I see that. Representation really does matter.
Can I just also say AOC?
Yep.
Crossing the aisle, having conversations with Republicans in the midst of this. There's something cooking there. It's interesting politics for 2023. Yeah. The story is not over. Not at all.
We've only just begun, to quote the Carpenters. Anyway.
We've only just
quoting
begun.
The Carpenters. The old guy, you know, all of a sudden is like, wait, I thought you were hip and Puerto Rican. Sabrina knows I'm not hip and Puerto Rican. Believe me. I listen to all white man music.
Are you just talking over my singing? My goodness.
Oh, I'm sorry. I do. Let's move on to our final segment, which we call Binge-Worthy, or What Are You Binging On?
Yeah. So something that you've watched. I mean, so many of us were trying to disconnect intensely. In December, we were all binging on a bunch of stuff, reading a lot, listening to podcasts. What's something that you've been binging on? And we're going to start with you, Sabrina.
I know. Can we start with Jamil?
Okay, Jamil. Jamil.
Hi, Maria.
Sabrina needs some more time to think about that.
I'm embarrassed. I'm embarrassed by my honest answers, so I'm thinking twice.
Oh, well, then, no. Hold up. Forget that, Sabrina.
No. No, okay.
What are you binging on? Yes, true. You have okay. to say. You must reveal. Go ahead, tell me.
The assignment.
I will. Actually, I'm not that embarrassed by this. Okay, I've been binging good. The Harry and Meghan documentary okay. on Netflix.
Oh, I would be embarrassed by that.
It's the zeitgeist.
I've become like deeply invested in that relationship. And now like Harry's done all the interviews with like Anderson Cooper and like Good Morning America. And I'm just here for all of it.
Interesting. To me, The Crown became more interesting because of Harry, to be honest with you. Although I haven't watched it yet. That was, sweetie, it's all about honesty here. It's radical transparency. We love you, even if you were even... And because you watch Housewives, in case you watch them, Jameel.
I do.
Oh, no. I do. No reality TV here.
She's like, yeah, I watch it. All right.
I do. I'm being fully honest. Why hide it now?
I love this. All right, Jameel, something binge-worthy?
I would say a few things I'm quote-unquote binging. First things first, I'm binging Joan Didion. I had never read her before. And when I moved to California, and I'm an essayist for the LA Times, I figured, like, let me read, I guess, one of the preeminent California essayists that's ever lived. So I'm starting with The Year of Magical Thinking, and I have a bunch of other books that I've bought.
Love it.
So that's what I'll be reading for a little bit. And also binging in terms of other forms of media. I would say a lot of movies that I hadn't seen from the past year. I just, you know, hadn't gone to the theater. So like Tar and The Menu and a bunch of other, and Woman King, a lot of movies that I hadn't seen, but also in a sort of less, I guess, sort of cheesier binging. I've also started to binge some of these, the true crime documentaries, not really hugely into like the spectacle of death, but I am interested to see how people tell stories. And so I watched The Night Stalker on Netflix, which I thought was very well done.
Ooh, I guess I wasn't planning on going after Jameel, but it leads me to the one that I just finished, which is true crime from, I don't know where, it's called The Serpent.
Mm.
And it's about a murderer.
I loved it.
Vietnamese, French.
Ooh.
And then I also was binging on The Fall, which stars Gillian Anderson, who I have recently discovered. So I'm watching everything British, and I'm just leaving the return of La Reina del Sur with Kate del Castillo. I'm leaving it for a special moment. I'm like, I'm not ready to binge you yet, girl. I just watched the first episode and then I'm like, you know, you're too good. I need to have you for a special moment, which is coming up in a couple of weeks. I'm looking forward to binging on that. Oh, by the way, also, I binged on The Last Cup, which is the most beautiful podcast if you haven't heard it. Oh, so beautiful.
Ooh,
Julio,
nice.
What's your binge?
All right. This is going to be a weird binge, but my daughter, Grace, came home. She works in DC and she was able to work remotely. And she's like, Papa, you know what I'm binging on? And I'm like, what? Modern Family.
Oh, that's a good one.
Oh,
that's a good show.
That's a lovely one.
As you know, I was on Colombian radio like 6-7 years ago, basically saying, you know, Sofia Vergara, just all these stereotypes. But now that I'm watching it again, it got smarter and it actually got more like complex in terms of identity and so Modern Family.
Love it.
Yeah.
Old school.
Also, can I just say, I want to propose a book club because Jameel, I recently bought Joan Didion's Miami. So
nice.
We should all read it at the same time.
I'm all for that.
Look at you. I'm in the thick book club. All right.
You know what? If you hook up a book club between like some of the ITT people and you actually make it happen and we show up, yo, that would be like some serious production. I'm there for that, Sabrina.
Ooh, I'm here for it.
See?
Yes.
We pull out a little tequila and we talk books and we don't talk. Oh, that would be fun.
Oh, man, the dream.
Okay. Sabrina Rodriguez, national political reporter for The Washington Post and budding book club creator. And Jameel Smith, essayist for The Los Angeles Times as he really moves to Los Angeles and settles in. The both of you, Jameel Smith, Sabrina Rodriguez, thank you so much for joining Julio and me on this episode of In the Thick and making it such a fabulous episode. Thank you so much.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Maria Hinojosa.
And I'm Julio Ricardo Varela.
Uno, dos, tres.
Dear listener, come on now. You got to go and rate and review us.
You sang The Carpenters.
That's right.
You got
to review that. Remember, you can listen to In the Thick on all major podcast platforms. Check us out on the web at inthethick.org. Follow us on Twitter and on Instagram at In The Thick Show. Like us on El Facebook and tell everyone you know to listen in 2023. In The Thick is produced by Noor Saadi, Harshana Hatta, Oscar Fernandez, and our New York Women's Foundation Unite Fellow, Daniela Tello Garzon. Our editorial director is Fernanda Santos. Our audio engineering team is Stephanie LeBeau, Julia Caruso, Gabriela Baez, and J.J. Rubin. Our marketing manager is Luis Luna. Thanks to Raul Perez for recording me. The music you heard is courtesy of Nacional Captain ZZK Records. See you on the next episode, dear listener. Thank you for listening from the Punta Cana studio. We'll see you in the next one. Bye. Oh, remember, no te vayas.
Peace, y'all. Any other taglines?
No te vayas, no te vayas. Ouch, I'm getting bit up by mosquitoes.
Hold on. Tell me where?
Hold on one second, you guys. I got to kill some mosquitoes right around here. Ouch. I mean, I suppose that could be taken in an interesting way, given that we're talking politics in this moment and you want to bat away these nuisances.
The opinions expressed by the guests and contributors in this podcast are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of Futuro Media or its employees.